Hey, welcome to another edition of the Indie Creators Podcast. My name is Walt Robillard, and I like to go one-on-one with guys who are making their own thing happen in comics. Today, we have indie creator Nick Garber out of Texas. Did I get that all right, sir?
Yep.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come with us today. You are the head ink slinger, writer, and design matron of Blackjack Studios. Can you tell us a little bit about the studio?
Blackjack Comics is a veteran-owned and operated studio. I started out in Sacramento, California when I was living out there. And we put out a comic books every quarter, sometimes sooner. And we have Phantom Hawk, The Last Pendragon, Sunscreen, and soon to be coming out, Corvid and Sparrow. Those are our main titles.
Nice. Well, before we start digging into your titles and giving people a place where they can go and make you rich and infamous, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where'd you grow up, sir?
I grew up in San Diego, California.
And as you have stated on a couple of different places, that Blackjack Comics is veteran-owned and operated. So can you delve into your military career a little bit?
I joined the Army in 1996 as a E-1 private with a Ranger contract because I wanted to jump out of planes and blow stuff up. So ended up doing that, you know, ran through the pipeline, basic, you know, AIT or advanced individual training, infantry school, then airborne school, and then the Ranger indoctrination program. And then after, seemed like forever, I finally got assigned to the Ranger regiment and I spent 2 years there.
Rock and roll. When you went through RIP, were they still over on Benning right behind the medical barracks?
Yeah. What is the name of that road? They ran us from airborne school the day of graduation, but they didn't tell us, none of us knew where the barracks was. They said we were running. I was like, all right, let's see how this goes. And I think they took the long way. We took some loops and things like that and ended up behind the green fence compound. And then I just remember being really scared of what I got myself into.
And they hadn't even thrown you into the pool yet.
No, not yet. I mean, no one even yelled at me yet. And I was like, I told the guys quit as soon as we got there. I'm like, why didn't you quit before the run? I'm not a fan of running, but if I had intentions of quitting, it was going to be before that run.
Hell yeah. When you came through, did they run you by Cardiac Hill as well?
Did Cardiac Hill. That was our first PT session. Day one of RIP. Was all around the airfield, up and down Cardiac Hill. And then as a break, they stopped and smoked us up for a little bit, you know, push-ups, sit-ups, flutter kicks. And then we thought we were going to go back to the barracks, but no, we turned around, went back down the hill, another lap around the airfield, up the hill one more time, and then started making our way back to the regiment.
Damn, rock and roll, man. So we got you going in and going into the military. How did the whole comics thing come about? Did you always read comics? Did you get into comics late, early?
No, I've been a comic book fan since I was about 7, 8 years old. My dad, well, my earliest like memory of anything comic book related was my dad had painted Superman and Spider-Man above my crib when I was a baby, and they had pictures of that. And I was apparently, when I was like 2, 3 years old, the old George Reed Superman shows would be on TV, and I'd watch those. And I would imitate those by trying to run through walls. It didn't work out too well. And then when I actually started getting really into comic books was, like I said, like 7 or 8, I was home sick with the flu. My dad was in construction, it was wintertime, so he wasn't working that day. He goes off to the drugstore, go get like cough medicine, and he buys me like a stack of comic books back when they were like 50 cents, 75 cents, you know. And the first one I ended up picking up was Daredevil. So I read that, yep. I saw that. I was like, yeah, we're going to have a good time on this show.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Daredevil was my hero because he was the kid that, you know, he was the short kid who was still making it happen even though he had lost everything.
Yeah, and he could have gone either way. I mean, he could have grown up and been a villain, you know, with everything that's happened to him, but chose the other way. And I'd never heard of like a superhero with a handicap. You know, being blind, I just thought that was really cool. You know.
Oh yeah, man, funny. Rock on. The when you started getting into the titles that you produce now, did Daredevil and any of these other guys influence any of the design process?
Batman was kind of like an influence. Some of the original designs of Phantom Hawk, he never had the cape. He was almost like a gunslinger, so he was kind of falling more to that Frank Castle Punisher type. And I gave him, I thought it would be really cool if he had like Old Navy six-shooter Colts, you know. But now, like, as the years went by and I started developing him further, I was like, oh, that's a stupid idea. Maybe I could throw it in an issue somewhere and then just have him kind of comment on why would he be using, you know, 200-year-old pistols. But I ended up going with the Karambits for that. Punisher was a design influence, Daredevil, Batman. I really like the street level type heroes.
Over the last few days, you know, we've been chatting it up and trying to you know, get ready for this. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I did was I bought your catalog. So I went through and picked up all the issues that you have, and you can definitely see influences from certain things here and there. But I want to bring it back to your art style. Are you classically trained or are you self-taught?
I was self-taught, and then I finally got some formal training many years down the road when I went to college.
Did you do the whole life study thing? Watch, you know, get all excited for the naked female models and then...
You know what? They never had that. I went to the art program. I went into the graphic art design program, and you had to take the traditional art classes, painting, figure drawing. And I'm like, all right, cool, figure drawing. I'm going to see naked girls, and I'm going to get to draw them. You know? What kid in college isn't excited about that? So, especially, I mean, at that time, I had just come out of the Army, you know, so a grunt's going to be a grunt, and anytime he gets to see a chance to see a tastefully nude woman on display for him to illustrate, he's going to jump that opportunity if he's so inclined.
That's how some of my dates started in the early 90s. So, yeah, I gotcha. Now, have you seen your design process kind of evolve as you've gone through the years? I noticed on your Facebook you had used yourself as a reference on for an upcoming illustration. So even looking at like Phantom Hawk 1 and like some of the stuff that you're doing now, you can see a progression. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh yeah, huge difference. When I first put the first issue together, I mean, this was just years of toying around with the idea. The character I created when I was 12 years old. So I've had him since late 80s, mid 80s. So my influences, I mean, I'm a huge Jim Lee fan. You know, his stuff's always kind of influenced me. I've always tried to kind of emulate that or mimic it. But there's been a huge progression as far as skill-wise and how I've progressed as an artist. And I was just through repetition. And when I put that first issue together, I had no idea what I was doing. I just decided one day I was going to make a comic book. I've been talking about it for years. My friends and family have been bugging me for years. When are you going to put out a comic book? So I locked myself in a room one day, wrote a script, and then started working on it. But I had no idea what I was doing. Sequential art is completely different than doing pinups and rough sketches and things like that. I mean, there was a lot of thought involved in there, and I don't think I put the time in that first issue or even the second issue to really tell the story the way I want to tell it as far as the illustrations.
And do you feel a little more comfortable with it now?
Yeah, I feel a lot a lot more comfortable. But there's always room for improvement, and I'm always, anyone that reads the book, I ask them to shoot me an email, shoot me a text, whatever, tell me what you think about it. If you see any flaws with it, if you have any suggestions, you have a critique, you know, I mean, that's the only way I'm going to get the book better. And that's what I really want, is to be able to put out the best quality book possible to the people that are going to spend their hard-earned money on my little indie book.
Well, I'm telling you, so far you got me, as far as Phantom Hawk goes, you definitely got me hooked on the story. So there was a couple of things in there where I was like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of digging this. So for the last couple of days, it's been a guilty pleasure. Going back to, I keep gushing over this because I'm having fun reading it. I just read issue 4 this morning.
Oh, so, nice.
Yeah, so that was kind of fun. Going back to the way that you're doing things now, the first issue, it definitely looked like either you inked by hand, or you went a little more traditional. Did you ink by hand when you started doing those?
Issue 1, 2, and 3, even though I didn't draw 3, all of those were drawn and inked by hand and colored digitally.
And now are you doing everything digital, or are you doing something?
No, I still do the pencil illustrations, old school analog, you know, lead holder and some lead, and I tried to do it digitally, and it just, the weight in my hand didn't feel right. So I wasn't getting the results that I wanted. It didn't look like my work. That might have been a good thing. I don't know.
And when you notice that, you know, you had this drive and you had this momentum building up in you to create your own comics, where'd the name Blackjack come from?
Came from 2 things. It was a card game it was the first card game I ever learned how to play with my dad. We used to go camping a lot when I was younger. It was always kind of a family deal. Like, my grandparents would show up and cousins would show up, and usually during the summertime, we'd spend about 2 weeks out by a lake or up in the mountains somewhere, just camping and doing that whole thing. And no electronics, so we played card games. You know, and he goes, hey, he showed me all these other card games, and I didn't really enjoy them that much. And he goes, well, have I ever showed you Blackjack? And I'm like, no, but I like the name. And then I get in the Army, and I start learning about some famous generals, one of them being Blackjack Pershing. And that guy was just a badass. You know, and all these kind of things just kind of sat in the back of my head. And then when I decided to put Phantom Hawk out, I'm like, well, I'm self-publishing. I guess I'll need a name like Marvel or DC or something like that. I'm like, I need something that's kind of catchy. So the name that just kept coming back up was Blackjack. I was like, you know what? I think I'm just going to roll with that. Blackjack Comics has a nice ring to it.
And when you started, was it just you? Because as you see the Phantom Hawk series go on, it seems like your crew gets bigger and bigger. Did it start with just you?
It started with just me. Just me, and I had to learn how to do all of it. I mean, the drawing I already knew how to do. The inking, I learned that it's more than just tracing. You know, it's an art form in itself. And the coloring, I felt like a kindergartner when I was doing it. I was like, oh man, am I inside the lines? Oh, this is looking bad. So I started gathering reference material, books, talking to some of my friends who are like traditional painters and you know, pick their brain on techniques and how to get that going and how to just achieve a really clean look. You know, and that first issue was just really rough. And then as we go on, the colors get a little cleaner, and then finally, some color artists started showing up. So I'm, hey, you want? I need a job. You hire? I'm like, I am, because I don't have to look this. And I want it to look great, and their work would be beautiful, and I just roll with it.
Rock on, man. Now, you got the first 2 issues that you were writing and slinging, mm-hmm. And then it looks like 3. You start picking up a crew. Mm-hmm. Did you have available talent to work from? Did you know where to go or where to look?
I didn't at first. Facebook has been like a tremendous help in, you know, finding a talent pool. And I found, just when I was living in Sacramento, I found a group that was called the Sacramento Comic Creators Group. And they met in a comic book shop. every Tuesday, and they would, you know, have little tutorials and things like that. And the artist, Neil, I have always trouble pronouncing his last name, Brangetzi, I think. I heard that he had worked for one of the big companies in the like late 70s, early 80s, and that was real interesting to me, and I wanted to talk to him about it. And the more I kept going, the more we kind of built this relationship. And it was actually my business partner, Joy, who's also a veteran, who was able to convince him to drop his page rate considerably to help me out on that book. And so he did the book, and it looked pretty good. And then when I moved to Texas, I got in contact with the local talent pool here, found a color artist, and he was at Abelio, and he'd been able to help me out. And it just seems like you said, with each new book, more people keep coming on board. I keep getting emails. People are submitting portfolios. And if I can afford them, then I pick them up, especially if the work's really good.
Rock and roll. I got distracted. Is that a Blackjack Comics coffee mug in your hand?
It is.
It's plug. I'm always on the lookout for new swag, so we're gonna have to talk after the podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
when you're bringing on this new talent, do you always try and look locally so that way you can deal like one-on-one, face-to-face?
I like to. I try to, if I can, and if the talents there, you know, hit up the local scene. But Sunscreen, which is another title of ours, issue 2 is getting ready to come out. And that was drawn by a guy in Illinois named David Jackson. The writer for that entire arc is a kid in Beaumont, Texas, which is like 8 hours away. His name is Trevor Bolin. And he's fallen in love with the character. He's done great things with it. You know, all I gave him was a background and a bio on, you know, who's who in the zoo. And he's like, okay, I got these ideas I want to run by. And I'm like, all right, great. So, and he's been doing great things with that. The Last Pendragon was drawn, it was written by me, but it was drawn by a soldier in my old battalion in Fresno.
Nice. And that's another book that I want to talk about as well, because you had a lot of neat ideas in that. One of the things that caught me most was the dad's look versus his look, but we can cover that later, because I was like, wow, that's pretty iconic. And I noticed that in the background you have a poster of and it looks like an older design.
It is, because the whole story behind the Pendragon was that there's a lot of them, you know, lots of living heirs of King Arthur. So the idea was to have them like through time, and that was the World War II version. So like his grandfather, great grandfather.
So that's somebody we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, it's something we haven't seen yet, and hopefully I can squeeze it in there. I kind of want to pick up some more momentum and get a little bit larger of a fan base, and then start branching off with, you know, like Tales of the Pendragon, and kind of go through and visit some of these earlier Pendragons. You know, a Pendragon in India during British occupation, and it would actually be an Indian Pendragon.
You know? Oh, that'd be pretty cool. Yeah, I'm definitely stoked on what you got going on so far. So, yeah, let's hope we can spread some Phantom Hog Blackjack goodness all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Going back to talent, did you I saw a couple of pictures where you were at conventions. Has conventions been a big deal as far as building what you have going on?
Oh, absolutely. Conventions, I know I used to go to conventions when I was younger to try and pimp my wares, or at least get information on how to make a career or a living doing that. And it was no different when I was on the other side of the table, you know, as a creator and as a publisher. A lot of people coming up. Some were a little bit more prepared than others. You know, they had a portfolio with them. I didn't give them a card, and I talked to them later, because conventions can get crazy, especially some of the bigger ones. But yeah, it convention's been huge in finding the talent and meeting local talent and then, you know, convincing them to come on board.
Do you have a lot of people coming up, hitting the table, wanting to know about what you have going on?
Yes. Yeah.
The how does it, you know, how do you pitch what you have going on when somebody's like, hey, what's this all about? Or do you, you know, do you have somebody dressed up in a Phantom Hawk who throws karambits around the crowd just in case?
No, not yet. That's the next step. Right now, all the money gets pumped right back to the company, putting out books, and hopefully we can get a little bit extra where I can have a quality suit made, and you know, instead of just some guy in some spandex, kind of have like, I would say like a movie quality version of the suit. And I've been getting quotes on that, and I would say probably in like the next year or so, I'll be able to pull that off.
But, nice.
But it's a real humbling experience when they come up there, and you know, and because I'm used to being on the other side of the table, you know, and then them pitching to me. So the first time I did it, I didn't know what to say. I didn't have a short pitch for anything. And I was just like, I pretty much told them the whole first issue. You know, it's like, hey, you got 20 minutes. I'll tell you, you know what, just pick up a copy. Let's read it together. You know?
Hell yeah, that's badass. It helps. It helps when you're willing to interact with fans, and not only are you the writer, but you're also the face of the company. So, mm-hmm. You know, when you get that fan rolling up to your table and saying, "Hey, you know, let me know what you got going on," I mean, just the fact that you know you're not only the knight but the king as well. I mean, that's pretty big.
Yeah, it's. But I just stay humble about it because being on the other side of the table, you know, these guys always seem kind of larger in life, and I don't know if that's how they see me, but it's definitely not how I want to come off. I want to be approachable. You know, if they ask me who drew this, then I feel, you know, pretty good. I'm like, oh, well, that was me. You know, I'm not like shoving in the face like, oh, come see what I drew, and you know, here, give me your money. But no, I'd rather just talk to them about it, and if they like it, cool. If they don't, that's cool too. You know.
Right on. Did have you had any moments at conventions yet where you had like a creator, either somebody that you know and have looked up to, or just somebody that has some name recognition? Have you had somebody come up and be like, "Hey, man, what's this?"
Yeah, Bradstreet came by my booth.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I didn't even recognize him. He was wearing it was during football season too, and he was wearing a Pittsburgh Steelers sweatshirt, and I didn't recognize him. Flipping through my portfolio, and he's like, "Oh, that's pretty good stuff. You're the creator?" You know, just beautiful questions. I'm like, "Yeah, I'm the creator." And I'm like, "But I can't sell any of these books to you." And he's like, "Why not?" And I'm like, "Well, because you're a Steelers fan. I'm a Bengals fan. It will never work. I can't take your money." You know, so yeah, laughed at him and he goes, "Hey, man, you got some pretty good stuff here. Keep it up." And then he walked on. And then I go back to doing what I was doing, and my buddy Bobby shows up and goes, "Dude, don't you know who that was?" And I'm like, "I don't know, some Steelers fan." He's like, "It's Bradstreet, dude." And I'm like, "Oh, I'm such an a-hole."
Nice. Nice. So, you know, when you break it big and, you know, you're sitting on the red carpet, you know, getting ready to unveil Phantom Hawk the movie or The Last Pendragon, make sure you throw a shout out to Bradstreet.
Well, I'm going to send him an invite. I'm like, "Hey, you don't remember me, but you went to this little con in Sacramento and like, 2012, and I was a bit of a dick." We're not really a dick, but I could have been nicer. I shouldn't have given you crap about your team. But
now we've been kind of dancing around your titles, and if you don't mind, I'd like to go through and you know, just kind of give people a basic idea of what you have going on, as well as through the miracles of video, we might be able to, you know, just show some covers and stuff like that. So why don't you tell us how Phantom Hawk came about and give us a basic pitch for him?
Phantom Hawk came about, like I said, when I was like 12 years old, 12, 13 years old. I was really into Nightmare on Elm Street at the time. And it was four Dream Warriors. I think it was, yeah, it was definitely four. But there was a comic book artist in there. and he had a character named the Phantom Stranger. And I liked his look, but, I mean, he had, like, that giant backpack and the guns and all that. But I thought it was cool, so I kind of emulated it a little bit. And then through the years of my military experience, I kind of just – I developed him further and refined his look. I mean, he went through a lot of changes. Eventually, I ended up giving him the cape, but I wanted the cape to be functional. Why would he need a cape? Well, the cape was made out of active camouflage that when he would go on missions, they'd use it to, you know, cache their gear. So they'd throw that on there, and when he wakes up in that first issue and he's got a duffel bag full of stuff that he eventually makes his costume out of, he didn't know what to do with it, so he made the cowl and the cape out of it so he could use it as camouflage while he was doing his reconnaissance and trying to dig more into what happened to him and who did it to him.
So a man on a mission searching for what he's become and trying to hold on to what he was?
Yeah, well, the pitch is, what I tell people at conventions is that he's a special forces soldier who gets framed for the destruction of the project that created him. So he's on the run with limited resources. An even shorter pitch is if Batman and Punisher had a love child who had no money, it'd be this guy. So, but yeah, he's soldier mentality. He's on a mission. And he's not going to stop until he reaches his goal.
And
die.
Yeah. And he has a, you know, I'm not going to spoil anything so that people can come out and go to Blackjack Comics and actually pick up your stuff through your store. He's got a limited time to do what he's got to do because there's some stuff going on with him.
He does. He has a really short amount of time. To figure out what's going on before the clock runs out.
Yeah, pressure is on. Now, he seems to have a friend and somebody that he tracks down in issue one, but there's a big amount of enemies arrayed against him, and one of the ones that we have that's real iconic as far as the look. I mean, even shows up in the first issue right on the cover. You have, at first when you first get this, you kind of feel like almost like this is what his uniform looks like, but then you realize this is a hint to what's to come. I mean, that's a pretty iconic looking bad guy.
Yeah, Black Shroud, he is the big bad. I don't even think I use his name in the first issue. You have no idea who he is. He's a guy in a mask, and he's obviously running the show. And without giving too much away, that whole time that Phantom Hawk's been off the grid and kind of collecting himself and, you know, collecting his information, this guy's been, he's been building an army and trying to go forward with what he started with Matt, with Phantom Hawk.
Now, was there a... was there any influence from the way that Stan Lee names his characters in naming Max?
Max Malone, Peter Parker. Yeah. Growing up as a Marvel kid, those influences definitely kind of hit you. You know, and I ended up catching it when all my characters had their first name and their last name started with the same letter. I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to switch that up a little bit. Don't want to follow the Marvel formula too much. But yeah, Max Malone. Originally, I was going to call him Nick Malone, but I was like, that's a little too egocentric. I'm naming him after myself. So I named him Max Malone. So his full name is Maximilian Nicholas Malone, and we have the same birthday.
Well, that happens a lot, especially, especially if you're the one controlling the pen.
Yeah, when you're trying to create like an entirely new person, you got to go with what you know or who you know. And a lot of my supporting characters are people that they're real people. You know, I've changed their names or I've used their nicknames and thrown them in the book that way. With a little bit of twist and amped up a little bit.
Now, is that how Gonzo came about?
Yeah, Gonzo is we served together in Iraq and in Kosovo. And his real name is Felix Gonzalez, and he is a bodybuilder. So he is a huge dude. And when I first started drawing it, he just started getting into bodybuilding. So by the time the first issue was out, or the second issue, and by the time I got around to the fourth issue, this guy has amassed so much size. And I showed him the drawings, and he's like, dude, my arms are so small there. I'm like, well, quit lifting. It takes me like 3 or 4 months to get this book together, and you're just making gains all over the place. You know, you're a freak of nature. So we had a good laugh over it. And yeah, Gonzo's a real guy. Downs is a real guy. Those tattoos are actually tattoos that he has.
So I was just gonna ask that. And for those at home who haven't bought the book yet, these are two characters that are in the book that kind of start following Phantom Hawk as not fans at first, but definitely fans by the time you hit issue 4.
Yeah, and I was worried when that happened that I made that relationship too fast. But and then when I was thinking about it, I was like, well, I need to create a situation where it's going to kind of force that relationship to happen. Still have a little bit of, you know, mistrust between them, but kind of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend type of deal.
One of the things I really enjoy is the banter back and forth between those guys. But another thing that I really enjoyed about the issues as I've gone through them so far, supporting cast, they're not incompetent, and that was a big thing so far. Can you tell us a little about that?
I wanted them to be not just like I don't want them to be window dressing for the hero. I want them to be independent, free thinking, intelligent people that you believe would interact with this guy, even though the situation is, you know, amazing and fantastic. And they're in this unbelievable situation where, you know, you got shadow governments coming after them and the mafia coming after them and things like that, that these guys would be able to hold their own and be able to think their way out of a situation and not completely dependent on the hero to pull them out of jams. You know, and in instances in the series where the hero gets captured or gets messed up and it's up to the supporting cast to come pull them out.
And that's where we are at, where I've read up to so far. But the cool thing was, you know, it wasn't like, you know, Daredevil's Foggy Nelson. Yeah. Foggy is a force to be reckoned with in that courtroom, but you know, you get a bad guy coming up and, you know, he's a wet donut, you know, and it's the same thing for a lot of these supporting characters. You could have a character like the one that he runs to in the first issue, who is very good at what she does, but if somebody were to come up in a traditional comic, you get that whole, oh no, my heel is broken and now I've fallen down because I'm a girl, you know. And instead, the reaction that we see in issue 1, I was like, now that's refreshing, that's fun.
Yeah, and especially in regards to female characters, you know, I don't want just like a sexy lamp in the you know, in the comic book. I want them to be very strong. I want them to be very independent. I want them to be able to kick a little ass. And even though she's a doctor and she's highly intelligent, she's going to have some opportunities throughout the series where she's going to get to kick a little ass. You know? And I hate it. Like every horror movie, when they start running, and this is like the protagonist, you know, running from Jason and they trip, you know, and you're supposed to believe later on that this person is going to destroy this evil being, you know. And I just try to stay clear of that. And there's times where I was writing it and was almost going that way, and then I would just kind of catch myself and change. I'm like, now we can do this better.
Now, as the issues go along, you start getting a little hint at what Black Shroud is up to, and the fact that he doesn't like to hear two things: I couldn't and no. Was there somebody that you based him off of as well?
He's kind of like an amalgamation of a lot of people that I know, a lot of officers that I knew. And I took that positive quality in them and I turned it into more of an obsessive compulsion, you know, or it's almost a negative quality. You know, he surrounds himself with the most competent people that he can find. And when those people with the skills that he's hired to, you know, to do, tell them no or they can't, it irks him. Even though he has the intelligence and the physical and fighting capability to do most of this stuff on his own, he's got so many balls in the air. You know, he's playing checkers with one hand, he's playing chess with his feet, and he's juggling with one arm, you know, to get this plan in motion, that he depends on these people and he expects complete loyalty and for them to figure it out.
And he gets disappointed at one point during the first issue. And unlike the trope of the mustache twirling bad guy or Darth Vader that just starts killing his subordinates left and right until he gets one that succeeds, this guy allows his subordinates to learn from a mistake. And even though he's stern about how he reacts, you still have that opportunity for redemption. It's kind of nice to see in a bad guy.
He doesn't see himself as a bad guy, and what he thinks he's doing is right. What he thinks he's doing is for the betterment of mankind. So even though he's willing to do that, you know, gray level stuff to accomplish his goals, he looks at everyone that he works with or works for him as an investment. And they have a huge skill set, and they probably have a lot of time and money invested in them. And it would just be a waste if he started killing them when they make him angry. You know, and it would also show he's really into control. And it's something I tried to illustrate throughout the series, is that he's always in control. Nothing phases him. Even when things go outside of what he planned, he doesn't overreact, he doesn't get angry. And in the issue I'm working on now, I allowed him to slip a little, because the things were just getting a little out of hand. So
he's going to rein everybody back in.
Yeah, he has that momentary snap, and then he reels himself back in. But control is really big with this guy, and being calm, cool, and collected, he prides himself on being able to handle any situation that's thrown up.
Now, are we going to, in upcoming issues, see why he's wearing that mask?
Yes.
We get another good look at him on the cover to issue 4, as he's standing pretty much like looming over Phantom Hawk. Mm-hmm. When I got to issue 4, that cover really, really punches you in the face, because it's a great cover. It seems to be a stark departure from the covers that you had in the past.
Yes.
Can you talk us through the design change that led to this cover?
I wanted to get a little more gritty with the covers. He is a gritty character, and the first cover for issue 1, the original cover, which I have laying around here somewhere, was Phantom Hawk on top of a police car, but it didn't make sense because that scene didn't exist in the first issue. And so I went with something a little bit more graphic and a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for? A little more stylized. But I really wanted to, give that foreshadowing of Black Shroud and him kind of being that ominous figure. And then with the cover for issue 2, I kind of wanted to display Phantom Hawk a little bit more. You know, and that's where he's kind of like going from the rooftops and doing like more like a Batman type pose. But the more I started writing these books, I wanted to get back to that grittier feel that I had with that first issue. And so when I got to issue 4, some of the concept sketches I had were Phantom Hawk kind of like in the bottle of a syringe, and Black Shroud kind of holding a syringe, and you know, just like anti-view looking up and being dark and ominous, and you know, kind of just showing that Phantom Hawk is in some real trouble in this issue. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and that's when the idea for the cover that you actually see popped in my head is that what's happening to him is kind of taking pieces away, kind of like burning pieces off of him. And Black Shroud's pursuit of Phantom Hawk is kind of really starting to take its toll. you know, along with whatever, what else is happening to him. So the I found a great color artist who's actually local, and I talked to him at the last con that I did. I was like, hey, man, I'm getting ready to do this cover for my next issue. I love your stuff. Would you mind coloring it? He goes, not at all, dude. So once I got the cover drawn, which I thought was a really well-done cover, even though I'm the one who drew it. But I really took my time, you know, and focused on the details. And then when I gave it to him, he just took it to another level. You know, and I told him what I wanted with the cover. I wanted it kind of gritty. I want these pieces coming off him to really stand out. And, you know, the whole idea is that it was kind of like burning off of him. And then he rolled with it, and it turned out fantastic. It's my desktop picture on my computer, and it's on my phone.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, rock on, man.
So it was more colors than my artwork. I mean, I couldn't have been happier with it.
It's really iconic. It really jumps out at you, especially like you said, that first cover from the first issue. You know, the really smart design elements in there, but this one, you get a sense of that looming presence behind him. But at the same time, with the colors, it kind of almost struck me like some of those old Indiana Jones movie posters from like back in the day. It had some of those color choices, and that was pretty wild.
Yeah, and since he did that, I was like, dude, you got to teach me how to do that, because you're not always going to be available, you know. He was able to do some videos, you know, of him working on the stuff, so I could kind of see his thought process and his color choices and his little tricks. And I was like, that's awesome. I can't emulate it, but it's fun to watch.
Hell yeah. The in the book, you call attention to a certain disease that is very prominent in society these days. Was that a conscious choice? Did you have somebody that in your life that suffers?
No, but at the time, it was really making the news. I think it was like when Michael J. Fox announced that he was suffering from that disease, and I've been a fan of his work, you know, since Family Ties. So that kind of like popped in my head, and with the MacGuffin that I have inside that book, it would make sense on why he would think he had it. And him being a soldier and trying to, you know, do what he can and fix himself, that, and if he thinks that's what it is, that's what he's going to pursue. So kind of wanted to bring light to that too. And then later on, I'm, you know, him being a soldier, I also want to focus on PTSD.
Yeah, that's a huge issue. I mean, the Army is throwing everything it can at the wall to see what sticks, to try and help soldiers overcome that stuff. So
yeah, and we've been dealing with it since, well, they used to call it shell shock, and you know, we're closer to understanding it than before, but we still don't have a handle on what triggers it in some people and doesn't trigger in others. You know, guys that have seen multiple tours of intense combat, Korngal Valley, Afghanistan, Iraq, guys wouldn't show one sign, you know, they come out of there just fine, you know, mentally stable, and you know, there's something going on with their brain physiology that's able to just compartmentalize that and deal with it. And then there's people that just stepped foot in country and, you know, it messed with them, you know.
Yeah, it's a very tough thing to deal with, and it's good that, you know, you got another avenue through comics to deal with it, so that people can, you know, see it first on the page and hopefully get the help that they need to, you know, take that next step to recovery.
Yeah, and I like bringing attention to it. And this series, just the character himself, and which you'll find out what actually happened to him, you know, for those of us that have served, we've all had friends that got injured or, you know, heaven forbid, they didn't make it home. And this was kind of a way for me to deal with some of that stuff also, you know, is to have this character who goes through similar experiences me or my friends or, you know, some of my battle buddies, and, you know, some of them got pretty messed up. They made, you know, they made it, but they're still pretty messed up. And what happens to the Phantom Hawk and the gift that he gets to be able to get, you know, survive that. You know, it was just something that it was wishful thinking. I just wish we that technology exists at the time. And then it was about 8 months ago, I was reading something that science is working on something like that. You know, being able to regenerate tissue and bone through stimulating stem cells with nanotechnology. You know, I was like, wow. Yesterday's science fiction is going to be tomorrow's science fact. And I just thought that was really cool.
I was going to say that same exact thing. I took it right out of my mouth. Well, we've been gushing about Phantom Hawk for a little while, but let's shift focus over to Mr. Pendragon, or Mr. Penn, as he's called in the book at some point. Mm-hmm. What brought about him, and how did you get involved in crafting that mythology?
I, in addition to being a huge fan of comic books, when I was little, my parents were watching Excalibur. I just thought it was really cool, and I wanted to know more about it. So I think that was on a Saturday. That Monday, I go back to school. I go to the library. I find, you know, age-appropriate books on King Arthur. And I read them cover to cover over and over and over again. And it's always been kind of an influence, and I love that story. I love that mythology. And then right about the same time that I created Phantom Hawk, I came up with Pendragon. I wanted a British character, but he, in the beginning, started out as like a Buckingham Palace guard who just, they picked the best and brightest, and then he is the defender of England and all of its realms. And then as I started doing more research, I started developing and started drawing him more, he kind of just evolved into what he is now. And then the old comic book, The Phantom, was an influence in kind of merging that mythology with what I had developed earlier and making it kind of like a father and son thing. But, and I ended up getting away from that, and it was going to be more of, so they think that it's one guy, that the best of them would become the Pendragons, whatever realm, you know, they were operating in. So all the British territories would have a Pendragon, you know, since America was, you know, originally British, you know, there would have been a story where you would have had a Pendragon operating in America in the 1700s.
Now, the in the beginning of the book, you see, you know, you see one variation of him, mm-hmm. and then and the look of that Pendragon was very iconic and very almost like harkening back to medieval, but then toward the end you have, you know, you get that taste of the appearance of the main character taking on that mantle, mm-hmm. and his look is actually really different, and this is the one that we're seeing on the screen right now. Can you talk us a little bit going through what led to those changes?
Yeah, that was the look in the beginning was more of a happy accident. He was supposed to look like that poster, or close to it, because the look was always supposed to be kind of contemporary to the time. And then the only thing that would be kind of a throwback to the Pendragon origins would be the helmet. And through probably the fault of my own, I didn't send him the reference pics, or I didn't really illustrate that point. And he just kind of took the ball and ran with it and came up with that look for both Mordred, not Mordred, but the villain, whom I don't even know if I mentioned his name. Baron Macabre is the villain in the first page. And he came up with both those looks, and he had that red against that gold armor, and you know, it just really popped, and I was like, wow, it turned out pretty cool, even though it's not exactly what I wanted, but I'm going to roll with it because I thought it was pretty cool. And then as it went on, he had the reference pics for the modern-day Pendragon, and he had that really iconic last page, you know, of him you know, coming out.
Yeah, that last image rocked, and the when the colors that you had going on at the end, you know, the power coming from the eyes, him coming forward. I was especially impressed with the work that they did coloring the eyes. That energy coming off the eyes, that really popped.
Yeah. Yeah, Sirkan Atabe used a colorist out of Turkey. Did a really good job. And, you know, we talked back and forth. He goes, well, what are these things coming out of the eye? And I'm like, just imagine being filled with so much energy that it starts just kind of oozing out of you. You know, he's having the entire lineage of the Pendragons, that energy just kind of pumping through his body. You know, just imagine what that'd be like, and it would be blue in color because that's the color theme of Avalon. Was I wanted that, like, that cool blue mist, you know, real Lady of the Lake, Excalibur type feel to it. And he goes, okay, I think I know what you're talking about. And he goes, give me an hour and I'll show you what I have. An hour later, he showed me that image, and I'm like, that's exactly it.
And, you know, with that image, we should be seeing a number two rocking and rolling when?
I'm in the middle of writing it right now. Had a couple of setbacks and had to work on another project to get that out on time, which it happens in the big companies too. I don't know why, as an indie book, I'd be above it somehow, but but it came up and humbled me real quick. And he's like, nah, that's not coming out on time. You're going to have to. You know, do that, but I'm in the middle of writing it. I got the outline out. It'll be continuation of that first issue. That story arc's gonna be about 3 or 4 issues, and it's really gonna kind of bring John into his own as being the Pendragon. This first story arc is kind of like I don't know if you remember the Greatest American Hero, that old TV show. So He's got all these powers. He's got the suit. He just doesn't have the instructions yet because he doesn't have the time. He's got a threat to deal with, so he's got to go figure out. He's got to pick it up as he goes along.
Yeah, that threat in the first book, it was just kind of funny because you have, you know, he's like, no, Dad, I don't want all this mystical mumbo jumbo. He's like, Dad, give me the mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you've been drinking again, haven't you, Pop? You know, it's just, and when I create dialogue, I'll sit around here in the office and I'll act it out so it kind of sounds, you know, like a real dialogue, like a conversation you would have. You know, so it would flow naturally, you know. So it wasn't like, hark, you know, I must tell you of your origins, you know.
Yeah, that it was a fun read. I really enjoyed it. And besides Pendragon, we have Sunscreen coming out. Where did that come from? And the thing is, when I read that one, you know, you had you, between both Pendragon and Phantom Hawk, you had like a certain style that I was starting to get used to over the books, and then the style broke when it went to Sunscreen because you had this huge amount of exposition setting up where all this is going. Can you talk to us about that?
I didn't write Sunscreen. This is when I was getting to the point where the company was evolving to the point where I couldn't do it all by myself. I couldn't write it. I couldn't draw it. I needed help. And Trevor Bolin, we met on Facebook. He, fan of the books, fan of the page. He sends me a private message one day, and he's like, hey, man, tell me about the Sunscreen guy. Because I love his look. You know, I think he's really cool. And he had actually hit me up earlier about a book he was trying to push and wanted us to publish. After reading, I was like, I couldn't in good faith take your book because I think you have something special. I think you should go to Image with it. You know, I think you should pursue it through that way. He's like, all right, cool. But I send him a quick bio on Sunscreen. And he goes, I'll write this for free. I'm like, are you kidding? He's like, dude, I'll write this for free. I love this guy. I'm like, I'm not going to stop you. You're going to do it for free. Cool. And then, you know, if it blows up, then we're going to definitely change the parameters of payment, you know, and, you know, pay you what you're worth. And so he wrote 9 issues in the span of a month.
How many? 9 issues?
9 issues. 9 20 to 22 page issues within a month. And just with the bios that I gave him and the origins of these characters, he was able to write this really in-depth story with, and you'll see in that first issue, it was a lot of text, you know, which usually I'm kind of against the comic books, but it seemed to fit, you know, like this narration, you know, mixed with these images, kind of giving a brief history of this world that we're entering. And then by the next issue, which that's being inked right now, that should be out in the next 2 months, it'll really start coming together as, you know, this epic battle, you know, that's like been carrying on across the stars, you know.
Yeah, it seemed you had in the backstory section, it very much struck me as almost like and God, I hope I don't get sued for saying this, Rom the Space Knight, a little bit, and how the race adjusted from one point to the other.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if that was a conscious influence of Trevor's when he was writing it, but yeah, there's definitely that present in there. A little bit of General Zod, you know, a lot of these, heck, even a little bit of Ultron in there, you know, which is great for, you know, May, pick up an issue of Sunscreen and related to the Avengers, it'll get you in the mood. But yeah, I really liked what he did with the villain too, is to take this character that was designed for one thing. And what I thought was really interesting was a society that had built itself on an established parameter of rules were willing to break those rules for their survival. And I found that really interesting and just very intriguing. You know, I created the guy and I was even sucked into the story. I was like, oh, wow, this is great, man.
I got a hint of the Godzilla movie, though, a little bit when reading it, because you get a taste of Sunscreen in the book in the first issue, mm-hmm. but then, you know, he's gone, and you get that backstory. Will we see more of him in issue two?
Yeah, issue two, you're going to get a little bit more of Sam Truman, which later becomes Sunscreen, and how he gets his name, which I'm sure, because every time I tell someone about, well, what book do you have next? And I'm like, oh, Sunscreen is coming out just before we released the first issue. He goes, Sunscreen, that's kind of a dumb name for a superhero. I'm like, it makes sense when you read it. You know, there's a scene in there where, and it's just, it's set up comedically, and it just, he nailed it. He nailed that scene. And the way David Jackson drew it, it really pops, and you're like, oh, okay, that's how he gets the name, and that's actually kind of funny. Yeah.
It seems to me like he's a young kid, right?
No, actually, Sam's around 30. He's give a little teaser for issue two. He's a NASA pilot, and that's what kind of puts him in that situation where he comes in contact with the entity that's going to make him Sunscreen.
You get a bit of that that crew in the middle of the issue.
Yeah. Yeah. You get, and when you're looking at it, you're like, well, what does this have to do with anything? And then as the series progresses, it definitely makes sense. By issue two, it makes sense of who that crew was and what happened. And okay, well, that first issue, now it all kind of makes sense. You know, so
I gotta know, though, Image Comics influence in some of those spacesuits with female ponytails coming out the back of the helmets?
Yeah, definitely like a throwback to the Liefeld, Silvestri days, you know, Wetworks, Wildcats.
Yeah, I saw that, and I'm like, I was geeking out. I was like, oh, I know where you got that.
When he first showed me the pages, that was done by another artist out of Turkey named Emre Sadir, and I was like, these are American astronauts. You got them dressed like space pirates. This is more heavy metal than what I was expecting. You know. And I'm like, well, before I talk to them about it, let me just keep going over the pages. I look it over. I'm like, you know what? It's got a real 90s image influence, so like you said, and I was like, I will keep it.
Yeah.
So I'm like, make sure you draw them just like that.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. So we're winding up on, we're coming up on an hour now. And first of all, I want to say thank you again for taking the time to talk to me and donating an hour of your time to let people know about Blackjack Comics. If people want to stalk you on the internet, what's the best place to find you?
There are multiple places for you to stalk me on the internet if you're so inclined. You can hit us up on Facebook, which is facebook.com/blackjackcomics. You can visit our website directly, which is www.blackjackcomics.com. There you can see what events we're hitting next. You can purchase digital downloads. You can purchase print-on-demand download, or not downloads, but print-on-demand options through IndiePlanet. And that's where we try to update everything, because then it gets sent to Twitter and Facebook and all that. And then you can also find us on Twitter at Blackjack Comics. And if you're going to be in the Anaheim area next month, we'll be at WonderCon.
Nice. And people should just come up to the table, sit down, and be like, tell me about Phantom Hawk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I won't be there. My business partner, Joy, co-owner of the company, she'll be there. And she is just as excited about these books as I am and the other artists that have, you know, worked on it. And she will be able to tell you everything you want to know. And she is just a pleasure to talk to today. So.
And last but not least, if people show up to the convention, they're going to be able to get their hands on a Phantom Hawk Karambit, right?
Not yet, but soon. I do have two prototypes made, but they're... sharp and functional, so probably not going to be handing those out just yet, but there are some swag things that we're working on, action figures within the next 2-3 years.
Oh, nice.
Just because I want a Phantom Hawk action figure, I want a Black Shroud action figure, I want a Killjoy action figure with the giant hammer, and I want to play with it on my desk.
Yeah, that scene, when I rolled the page on that scene with Killjoy and our friends in the car, I was laughing. That was wild. Yeah, golf swing.
Yeah, in the script I wrote and under Killjoy, when I'm describing the scene, it's like, with that giant hammer, golf swing into the car, Tiger Woods style.
Oh yeah, they nailed it. That was a fun shot in the book. That was a pleasant surprise when I turned the page.
Oh yeah, that was when I saw it when I was reviewing the pages. I was like, oh dude, he totally nailed it. He got it. He knew exactly what I wanted, and that's probably one of the better pages in the book.
I can roll, man. So that's gonna be all for us for today. So when you got some more releases coming down, would you be willing to come back on and chat some more?
Absolutely. Had a great time.
We really appreciate it, man. Number one, thank you for your service. Number two, thank you for putting these books out and calling attention to some of the things that you're calling attention to. My name is Walt. I'm hosting the Indie Creators Spotlight. And we've all been on with Nick. And we look forward to seeing you again.
You too. Thanks for having me on, Walt.
Rock and roll, man. And we're out.